I really love math. I really do. I love the fact that I can be really creative when I do mathematics. But sometimes, believe it or not, my students don't love math as much as I do. I am used to students really saying that they're really scared of math and that they're afraid of it. And so I thought many years ago when I started teaching courses on mathematics at art that I was doing a scary thing math and a fun thing art. And actually one of the things that I discovered from my students is that art is actually scarier than math. And for my students, when they come to college, when did they have their last math class? They had their last math class last year. When did they have their last art class? Probably sixth grade. So they draw like little kids, and it's embarrassing for them. When I started teaching math and art classes, I found out that my students really loved the math, and they were scared of the art. So today what I'm going to show you is how knowing mathematics can allow you to be really creative and to draw beautiful things in art. To show you what I mean, I want to show you some of my student artwork. So this is from a student who I had 2 years ago. His name is Tim Tillman. This is his first art piece. I asked all my students coming in to draw me a picture of Plato's Allegory of the Cave, which is a bunch of people trapped in a cave looking at things. This is Tim's picture. Isn't this beautiful? He's a freshman in college when he did this. This was his first. This is another one of my students. This is Kara Kramer's beautiful picture. Can you see this? Is it possible to get the lights down just a little bit? Will that be all right? This is another student, Sid. He's from Pakistan. This is his picture. Okay, this is my students, right? This is my students at the beginning of the semester. At the end of the semester, taking a course in math and art with me. This is Tim's last picture that he did for me. This is Sid's last picture. You can see he wrote his name on it. Pretty cool. Okay. And this is Kara's last picture. Okay. So math really allows you to do cool things that you couldn't do necessarily before. Oh my gosh. So, sorry, Ivor Peterson told you that when I was raised by a pair of physicists. I'm going to tell you just a little story about this pair of physicists. When I was growing up, I remember walking home with one of my friends and saying, if we go to your house instead of mine, we'll get more done per unit time. And then I realized that other kids did not say per unit time. That's what it was like growing up with my parents. And the reason that I say that is my dad just walked in right there. So that's another Dr. Cornell. Hi, Dad. So cool. I don't know if this is this the first time you've ever seen me give a talk? No, okay. All right. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, what my students are learning to do is they're learning to take the three-dimensional world around us and portray it on a canvas. And we know that people first really started to learn to do this in ways that seem to us nowadays to be realistic. We learned to do this during the Renaissance. And so you'll see this incredible shift in the way that people portray the world around them in Renaissance art, which is also a time when people were learning a lot of math. And so you'll see pictures that look like this. This almost looks like a postcard, doesn't it? Doesn't it look like somebody like took a photograph? This is by a guy named Canaletto. His name wasn't really Canaletto. It was really something else. But he painted so many pictures in Venice where there's so many canals. But just like Cinderella was called Cinderella because she slept with the cinders, he's called the guy who paints all the canals, Canaletto. And we actually know that he didn't use math to do this. We know he used a mechanical device called a camera obscura. It doesn't mean like a photographic camera. Camera is the Latin for a room, and obscura means dark. So it was sort of like a giant pinhole camera kind of thing. And so we know how he did this, but it was not with a photographic camera. And we know that people often do things like this with mathematics. So this is what people learned to do in the Renaissance with mathematics. Now, as I tell you about these cool rules about how to make things look real, I want to help you avoid something that C.S. Lewis calls chronological snobbery. And so I want to tell you that modern-day artists, when you see modern-day artists avoiding these rules, it does not mean that they are stupid. So you'll see people doing things like this, right? And you'll say, oh my gosh, well, he just doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, David Hockney is an amazing artist. He definitely knows what he's doing with perspective. And he actually is breaking the rules on purpose. That's one of the things that good artists do. They learn the rules, and then they break the rules on purpose. So I'm not going to teach you how to break the rules. I'm going to teach you what the rules are. Why do people break the rules? Well, here's one example of why somebody... Oh, so sorry, this is just another picture by Hockney, just to show you he really does know how to draw things that look very good. Isn't that good? That's really good. Okay. Okay. So this is why people break the rules thing, and we're going to turn it around here. This is Marmaduke saying, no, it's not influenced by Picasso. My model wouldn't sit still. Well, that's what Hockney and Picasso and other people who make these weird pictures that we think of as really weird, that's what they're trying to do. They say, we do not sit still and look at the world and remember it in this particular way. We walk around through the world. We see a chair from various sides. We see a dog from all over the place because dogs move around. This is a picture of a dog moving around. It's not a picture of a dog sitting still and posing. But I'm going to teach you about the sitting still. So I want to talk about what happened with a very famous artist named Albrecht Dürer, who is a real hero of mathematicians for a variety of reasons. This is a very famous etching by Dürer that mathematicians love because Dürer actually put a whole bunch of mathematics explicitly into this picture. For example, if you look up here in this corner, there's something called a magic square. There's a bunch of numbers in there. The rows all add up to the same number. The columns all add up to the same number. And it's very cool. This is melancholy. Nobody knows why it's called melancholy. I think she's trying to solve a problem, and she's just having a hard time figuring out the answer. I think that's why she's melancholy. But she's got a compass in her hand, which you would use to do measurements, especially if you're a geometer. There's scales there to measure things. There's an hourglass. There's lots and lots of symbols of mathematics in this. This is some evidence that not only could Dürer do a really good job of drawing, but he also really loved mathematics. And we know that from a variety of other things in his life. This next page is more than you want to know. So just in case you're wondering like when where we are, Brunelleschi, who is often credited with being one of the first people to do a really good perspective piece, was about 1446 is when he died. Albrecht Dürer came along in 1471, and what I want you guys to see are two things. One is that Dürer bought a copy of Euclid's opera, that means his collected works, and translated it. Isn't that cool? Okay, so that shows you one thing is that, right, Euclid was a great mathematician, so Dürer was obviously interested enough in math to go ahead and translate something. But for us, the important thing, these 2 days are the important days. In 1509, we actually think that Dürer managed to get his hand on a perspective book. He really wanted to learn how to do perspective mathematically. And we have indirect but very strong evidence that he actually did get his hands on a copy then, and I'm going to show you what kind of evidence we have. And in 1525, he actually wrote a book on how to draw, and it included a section on perspective, and I'm going to show you some pieces of that book. He actually did a subsequent version of that book, too, so we published it. So what's the indirect evidence that he could learned perspective? Well, before 1509, this is a picture from 1498, he did pictures that looked a lot like this. He cared a lot about proportions, so that the people in his pictures are very well proportioned. This is St. Jerome and the lion. You can tell that it's St. Jerome because St. Jerome plucked a thorn out of a lion's paw when the lion was hurting, and so the lion in gratitude just followed St. Jerome around and was his obedient servant for the rest of his life. Just a little miracle right there. But the picture, notice it's outdoors. There is some sense of depth. There's a building way back up there. But the perspective is almost like atmospheric perspective, right? There's not a lot of straight lines in here. And those were the kinds of things that Dürer was doing before he learned mathematically how to do perspective. How did he do St. Jerome after he had perspective? Well, you have a copy, actually, in yellow on your hands. In 1514, he did this picture right here. And notice the difference in the way you portray space in here. Here, the whole room is all straight lines. And so Dürer actually knew how to do these incredibly razor-sharp straight lines and how to make them all line up and be really beautiful and give you this real sense of depth. So this is his St. Jerome afterwards. He did the St. Jerome at the same time that he did the melancholy picture that I showed you. Now, the fact that Dürer knew how to do mathematical perspective did not mean that he always did it. He could do it. It was a tool in his bucket. Here's another picture that he did at exactly the same time. It was Night, the Death, and the Devil. And again, this is just a picture that's outdoors. So just because he knows straight lines doesn't mean he has to do it. Okay. But he has this tool. So how do the straight lines, how do you do the things with the straight lines that give you the sense of depth? Well, I think I told you that he wrote a book on, called a treatise on drawing, a treatise on painting. And most of the stuff that he has in this book would not seem to you like stuff you would learn about if you were taking a drawing course nowadays. This is a very famous book. It's in a lot of college libraries. It might be in your college library. I know we have a copy in ours, and it's translated also. So you can get the English version as well. But he spends a lot of time talking about even how to draw letters, right? Because you didn't have computer fonts, so you had to figure out how to do it. look at how carefully he's labeling it in all these beautiful little circles. There's this really long description up here of, like, how to draw an E, all the different where the circles go. And then he's like a mathematician, because down here he says, oh, and F is just like a corollary to E. You just leave off the bottom line. So pretty good. It's not until the very end of the book that he finally gets into how to draw things in perspective. And he starts by talking about how to draw a cube. So notice there's lots and lots of words, right? Isn't that a beautiful letter? Right? Lots and lots of words. And then he says, okay, so you draw this cube down here at the bottom. There's this light up here that's causing a shadow. And there's all these letters in here. There's a weird, mysterious floating eyeball. And other stuff down here. And so he's talking about that. And then he gets to the next page, and he says, and then you do some more things up here, and you can see there's the sun and the cube and the weird, mysterious floating eyeball. And so that's how you do it mathematically. We're going to come back to this. He was not a one-trick pony by all means. He loved mechanical means. And so in his book, he actually has a bunch of mechanical ways to draw perspective, and I'm going to show you some of these. So here's one. If you happen to have something that's clear that you can see through, like this, then you can have a stylus that has a little hole in it. You look through that little hole up there, and you paint this guy right here, right up that. And it's very important to hold your eye really still, but that's one way that you could do this. Here's another way that he has, and this is actually reproduced in all sorts of art books on perspective and how artists did things in Dürer's day. And because it's reproduced so often, I thought I would explain in detail what's going on in this particular picture. So this is a picture of how to draw a lute, a foreshortened lute in perspective. So for this technique, you need two people. So you get a good friend and you have a lot of time. This person holds a little pointer down at some point of the lute. And this pointer is attached to a rope that comes up here to a little bolt on the wall. And it goes through that little round bolt, and it hangs down. There's a weight right there. And this, the idea of this weight is to keep this string as straight as possible. This is like a straight line. Okay. Now, what this guy is doing here, he's got some frame with a hinge on it. I'll come back to the hinge in just a second. And what he's doing is he's taking two little strings. They've got wax on the end, and he sticks one string top and bottom with wax, and he sticks another string side to side with wax, so that little X they make is exactly where this string comes through. Okay? So you know where they are. Okay, so then this guy, let's go on this little pen. Now the canvas is on a hinge. So you swing the canvas closed, and where those two little strings cross, you put a little dot there. Okay, and then you swing it open again, and then you move this stylus around, and you do this all over again, moving the little strings. This is the original dot matrix printer. And it was just about as fast, too. So we don't actually think people really would ever do anything like this. Would you do this? I would not do this. And as a matter of fact, when Dürer finished this book, he dedicated it to his very good friend, Pirkheimer. And his Pirkheimer's sister wrote to him and said, a book has now reached us, which Dürer dedicated to you about painting and measurement. Our gracious Duke had it bound for us and presented to our painters. We enjoyed it, but our painters think she doesn't need it. She can practice her art just as well without it. So, you know, if that was Siskel and Ebert, two thumbs down. But nonetheless, Dürer actually did do a follow-up version to this where he had two more ways mechanically to try to draw things in the real world. And both of these mechanical ways to try to get the artist further back from the canvas. So I'm going to show you these just to show you that that's important, because that's going to come up again later. I'm talking about why to be far from the canvas. So here's one down here. This guy is, again, looking through something clear. I have no idea what they were looking through. But this material is, he's got a tube that he's looking through. But the tube is connected to a string, and the string is connected to some bolt, again, back here on the wall. So that's sort of like the mysterious floating eyeball being way far away from the canvas. Notice how far this is from the canvas. Or if you don't want to paint a vase and you want to paint naked women, you could do it this way. Probably some of you, when you were in art classes, you might have taken like Sunday comics and tried to make them large, and you did something like this. So what he's doing is he's looking through a grid right here. He's not drawing on the grid, he's looking through the grid. He's standing right here, holding his eye very still with his stylus, making sure it's in the right place, and he's tracing what he sees on this grid down onto a grid down here. And so that's how he's drawing her. Okay. So again, notice that what you're doing is essentially you're trying to mimic looking through a window. So these are the mechanical ways that Dürer was was looking at how to draw a perspective, but I actually am really much more interested in this particular way right here. So, is this really math? Well, I claim that this is really math. Look at all these letters here, how he labels everything. I mean, look, how does a mathematician tell a bedtime story, right? We say, once upon a time there were three bears, B1, B2, B3, right? So this is math. He's labeling everything. This is good. So what's the math that goes into drawing cool pictures? Well, here's how we go. So we're going to leave Durer and we're going to come to... We're going to start off with some really simple ideas. The big idea behind perspective painting is that light travels in straight lines. Now, Albrecht Dürer and Leonardo da Vinci and many of the artists of the time did not actually know how our eyes see. They thought there was something from our eyes, you open up your eyes and some eminence goes out and reaches onto things, and you know, so the power is coming out of you to grab onto things. In the same way that if I want to feel this table, I have to put my hand to the table. The table doesn't jump out to my hand, so there must be something from my eyes that jumps out there. However, Leonardo da Vinci and Albrecht Dürer, they knew that even though you can feel around a corner, you can't see around a corner. They knew that whatever was happening happens in straight lines. So these lines are coming through here, and once you have straight lines, you're in the realm of mathematics. And so this has very important consequences, this idea. When we draw a picture in perspective, usually what we assume we're doing is we assume that we're drawing on a planar surface, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. You can, of course, draw on other shaped canvases, but I'm not going to. So we've got another thing that mathematicians love to talk about, which is planes right here. Okay, so how does this work? Well, you've got these photons coming in. This is probably bad physics, but okay, there's this green photon coming in, bouncing right in here. And what happens is when this line intersects the plane, lines and planes intersect in a point. So there's a single point. So you put a little green blob of paint right there. And then, okay, this is really much worse physics. There's a brown photon right here, whoop, right, and the brown photon, you put a little brown blob of paint right there. And if you do this for everything that you see in the world, eventually what you can do is you can take away the whole world, and as long as this world does not move, and as long as this world keeps looking with one eye, okay, what squirrel would do that? But if that happened, the squirrel would have no idea that the world had disappeared, right? It would still look like it was there. That is the big idea behind perspective. That make sense to everybody? Okay, good, because we're going to do some cool stuff with it. So here's one of the things that is a nice consequence of this. Now, because light does travel in straight lines, things that are further away from us seem smaller to us. I've occasionally seen like philosophical arguments about, well, things that are further away from us are not important to us as important, so we draw them smaller because small things are not. No. It's nothing to do with that. But this tree and this tree, they're the same size, but this tree is further away, so it subtends a smaller angle, and so it has a smaller image on the canvas. So that's why things that are further away from you seem smaller. We're going to do an experiment right now. Okay, here's a question for you. Which is bigger, my hands or my head? This is not a trick question. My head, okay? So my head is bigger than my hands, and so my head is also probably bigger than your hands, right? Okay, now, hold your hands up like this. If everybody doesn't want you, don't look stupid. Look at my head, okay? Which looks bigger? Your hands definitely look bigger than my head, right? Things that are further away seem smaller to you. You know that. Okay, good. All right. So, if you like algebra, this is the only page that we're doing that actually has algebra today, but if you like algebra, you can do this with algebra. Okay, so how do you do this with algebra? Well, if you're trying to measure something in the real world, it has a height. So in the real world, it's a big H, right? The height of the real world, the height of the object in the real world compared to the distance to the object in the real world, that's your big D, is proportional because of similar triangles. The height of the object in the picture compared to the distance to the picture. This very simple looking formula, even if you're sort of like shaking on algebra just a little bit, this is not as bad as a lot of the things that you've seen in your textbooks, right? This is not bad. This is what makes Toy Story look three-dimensional, where like Fred Flintstone is flat, okay? The way that you make these animated characters in the computer look like they actually live around in three space is just this simple formula. That's all you do. As a matter of fact, you can like draw beautiful pictures in Excel if you know where everything is in the world. So, okay, so if you do like algebra, though, and you think, oh, yeah, that's really easy, I have a puzzle for you. I'm not going to tell you the answer. So for those of you who think, oh, yeah, similar triangles, really easy, here's a quick puzzle. So imagine you have an artist drawing a picture of a squirrel on a 3-foot cubicle pedestal. Now, in the real world, the back of the cube is the same size as the front of the cube. But in the picture, we know that the image is smaller, right? And you can actually put your ruler down on the picture, and you can actually measure that on your picture. So you can measure, for example, that on the picture, the image is only 9/10 the size of the front. So the question is, how far was the artist from the squirrel? Now, this kind of a question actually comes up a lot in something called photogrammetry. If you want to, like, analyze satellite data, or you're taking a photograph of a crime scene and you want to reconstruct, like, how far did the car skid based on the skid marks, you want to be able to look at a photograph and figure out things again about the real world. And that little algebra formula that I told you also tells you how to go backwards. So that's a cute puzzle. And if you love puzzles and you want to know the answer at the end, or you think you have an answer and you want to check it with me, let me know. So this is your puzzle. But I'm actually not going to do algebra for the rest of things. I want to just draw really pretty pictures. And so I'm going to say, well, let's just talk about the geometry. Now, since light travels in straight lines, there are some really lovely geometrical things that we can say about the way that we see straight lines in the real world. So if I'm trying to draw a picture, especially if I'm trying to draw a picture with architecture, there's usually a bunch of lines that are parallel to each other. For example, in this room, there's these beams that are going back. They're all parallel to each other. And there's these things that are there parallel to each other. And it turns out that there are certain directions in the real world that I can look and see these lines, and there's other directions I can look and not see these lines. So let me show you this. So here, if the squirrel looks in this direction, the squirrel sees the line. So the squirrel draws the line on the canvas. And here the squirrel sees the line, so the squirrel draws the line on the canvas and so on. But there is one direction where the squirrel can look and see the canvas, but not see any of these lines, even if they're infinitely long, these lines. Does anybody know which direction that is? If the squirrel is looking parallel to the lines, the squirrel can't see them, right? Because parallel lines do not intersect. So if the squirrel is looking up here and looking at this line, looking further along the line, and eventually looks parallel to that line seems to vanish like that. That's what a vanishing point is. Now, artists usually think of a vanishing point as like lines where everything sort of converges to it. They think of it as a converging point. But the truth is that the reason that all of these different lines happen to sort of go to the same vanishing point on the picture is because all of these lines are parallel to each other, but they're also parallel to the line of sight. If the artist is, the squirrel is looking through a straw here, the squirrel can't see any of those lines at all at the same time. And that's why all of those lines vanish all at the same time. And we'll see some examples of this in art in just a second. This is a math talk, so I have to do theorems. Okay, so I'm going to do theorems. Here's my three theorems that we're going to do. One of the things that happens when we're drawing pictures of perspective art is if we have a collection of parallel lines in the real world that are parallel to the canvas, so that means that those lines, even if they go on forever and ever, they'll never intersect through the canvas, they'll never pierce the canvas, then it turns out that their images on the canvas are parallel. But if you have a collection of lines in the real world that are tilted compared to the canvas, they're not parallel to the canvas, then they have vanishing points and their images all converge to the same vanishing point. And the other really cool thing is that even if you have a single line in the real world that's not parallel to the canvas, that line has a vanishing point. So just think about it. If you're drawing the railroad tracks, most of you guys know you draw the railroad tracks and they sort of go up to a point, right? But if you took away one of the railroad tracks, it's not like all of a sudden the other railroad track would all of a sudden jump up into the sky, right? It would stop there at the edge of the ground. So a single line all by itself can have a vanishing point. And having said that, what we're now going to do is we're going to try a simple exercise together. I want to try to draw a cube, right? If Durer could do it, we can do it. And the same way that Durer did it, I want to do this in something called one-point perspective. So what does that mean? A cube has three big directions, three important directions, and I'm going to assume that two of those directions are parallel to the canvas. So like up and down, the vertical directions are parallel to the canvas, and one set of horizontal directions are parallel to the canvas. And so by this right here, it means that I can draw those lines parallel. So this is my first step in drawing a cube. Okay, first step. Everybody with me? Right, these two lines are parallel to the canvas, and so their images are parallel together. Okay. So, when I learned to draw cubes when I was in school, what I did was I took a square like this, and then I took another square like this, exactly the same size, and I moved it over diagonally, and I drew the lines between them. Okay, And that's a good symbol for a cube, right? It is a good symbol for a cube, the same way this is a good symbol for a heart, even though this doesn't look like your heart. Okay? But it's not a good perspective image of a cube. Why not? Because the back is further away, so it should have a smaller image. Okay, so instead of doing that, how should I draw a cube? You can see I'm used to like waiting for my students. I should use a vanishing point. That's good. Okay, and since I want everybody to get a chance to talk, tell the person next to you, where do I put the vanishing point? How do I know where it goes? Tell the person next to you. Answer? It's not easy, isn't it? Right? And this is something that an artist would really want to know. Anybody have an answer?
Well, in principle, you can put it anywhere, but I think you want to put it outside the face.
Okay. So I could put it anywhere, but I want to put it somewhere. I think that's actually a really good answer. Am I allowed to put the vanishing point anywhere? Right? Okay. Yes. And yet I'm going to claim that there are good places to put it and bad places to put it, the way that you said it. So let's go back and think about what vanishing points mean and think about what it means. I claim that once you put down a vanishing point, you're making an important statement about what you want people to do. So we're going to go to the plant, back to the plan view. I ran out of squirrels. So, okay. So I'm going to try to introduce the plan view. This is courtesy of my colleague, Mark France, who's really the smart one to help me with all this. So here's what you're seeing. This is the side. I'm going to do the side view first. This is the side view. So this is a guy. He's looking. This is his eyeball. You can see that that's his nose, and that's his ear. See that? There's his ear coming off the back. Yeah, the guy's looking forward. Okay, good. So this is, he's looking here. Okay, so that's the side view. And then this is the top view, but I can't tell my left from my right, so he's a one-eyed guy. He's like Odin or a Cyclops or something. So this is his two ears, and that's his eye and that's his nose. You got that? Okay, good. So this is what we're seeing, and this is the picture plane, and this is the cube that he's looking at. Okay. Now, we've already drawn the front of the cube. We've already drawn this part. We've already drawn that part. What's the vanishing point? Well, what we're trying to draw is we're trying to draw the lines that go away from us into the distance. That is, we're trying to draw these lines, and we know that the vanishing point happens when you can't see these lines, right? When you can't see these lines, they vanish. When can you not see these lines? When you're looking parallel to them. So when he's looking parallel to this, that's when he's vanished. This green line of sight is his line of sight where they vanish. That means the vanishing point is up here. But see what this says? This says that we've placed him in a particular place. If we put the vanishing point up here, we've actually placed him above the cube. You see? And so when you look at this picture, it means you're supposed to be looking from above. And similarly, over here, if the cube is off to the left, if I'm looking parallel to this line, the vanishing point is going to be over here. So once you put the vanishing point down, it says something about where you are supposed to look at the picture from and where the artist was looking at the picture from. Let me show you an actual practical example of this. Remember this picture of Canaletto? Okay, that we saw. This is a beautiful perspective piece. This is in one-point perspective, and you can see this because these lines, in the real world, these lines are vertical, and their images here on the picture are vertical. And these lines in the real world are horizontal, and their images are horizontal. So we've got two directions that are parallel to the canvas. But in the real world, this line is probably horizontal, but in the picture, it's going up. And in the real world, this roof line is probably horizontal, but in the picture, it's going down. See that? So those lines in the real world are not parallel to the canvas, and they have these images that converge. And you can see the vanishing point must be over here, because that's where all these lines are converging. And that tells you something about where Canaletto was. Even though this happened centuries ago, we now know because of just looking at this here today, that he was standing on this side, and he was painting everything over here to the left of him, and he was not painting anything to the right of him. And so if you want to go recreate this picture, try to take a photograph from where Canaletto was. That tells you where to stand. Isn't that cool? I think that's pretty cool. Okay, so now let's go back and let's do our cube. I want to be above and to one side of the cube, either the left or the right, whichever one works out well. Okay, so this is the beginning, the next step in my cube. I've got a vanishing point. It's up above and off to one side. And notice how it looks like you can see the top and the side. Now, this is not yet a cube because this is like something infinitely long going back into the distance. So what do I need to do next? Just sort of cut it off. So you put one line in there, and that's sort of going to finish it off really well. So I'm going to put a line right there. Oh, that's good. Okay, and then I know how to finish. And this is my cube. There's my cube. Is this a good cube? You like my cube? You guys think it's too long? Okay, all right, we're going to have a vote. Either it's a cube. So when Mark France, my colleague, when he was taking these art classes, in math you just sort of, you turn your homework into the teacher and the teacher grades it and hands it back sort of anonymously. But in art what you do is you get up and you walk around and you look at everybody else's stuff. So he would be drawing a picture and then he'd get up and he'd walk around and look at other people and go, oh, this is really good. And then you get back to this and you go, oh. So you come back to this, did I draw a cube or did I draw a dumpster? I don't know. So let's have a vote. How many people think I drew a cube? And how many people think I drew a dumpster? Oh, no. Okay, well, you're all wrong. It's a cube. So, oh, you don't believe me. Okay, so let me try to explain why I'm right. You're right, too. But let's go back to the plan view. So we're going to do some math. We're going to do some geometry. So here's Odin again, the Cyclops guy, from the top again, right? Those are his ears and his eyes and his nose. And I drew a weird, mysterious orange line on top of the cube. See that? Actually, you can sort of, it's sort of bleeding through. I'm sorry. I'm going to take this out so it doesn't bleed so much. Okay. So I put a mysterious diagonal orange line on top of this. Okay? Now, this is not a hard question. Is this diagonal line, is this parallel to the picture plane? No. Okay, good. That's the correct answer. So because it's not parallel to the picture plane, by that third theorem that I told you, it means that it has a vanishing point. When does it vanish? It vanishes when you're not looking at it. When are you not looking at it? When you're looking parallel to it. So if Odin is looking parallel to that orange line, he can't see it. So it has a vanishing point right here. And if that orange line is on the top of the cube, then even though it's diagonal, it's a horizontal line, so it's going to vanish somewhere on the horizon. So that means that we can put that orange line into the picture. As a matter of fact, here it is. Okay, so there's my cube. There's that first vanishing point that I showed you, and there's that diagonal line going off to the horizon and then ending there because it doesn't jump up into the sky. Okay, that does not tell you that this is a cube, but it's getting close. Because why? Well, this triangle right here on the top of the cube is one that mathematicians love. This is like one of our very favorite triangles in the world. If this really is a cube, and that's it. Because why is that our favorite one of our favorite triangles? It's an isosceles triangle. These two sides are the same. It's a 45-45-90 triangle. That's great. And for us, the thing that's really important is that this side and this side of the triangle are exactly the same. Does anybody see any more of my favorite triangles in this picture? Yeah? Okay. So there's one over here, too. But notice this one is another one of these, right? Because we said this vanishing line right here is parallel to this, and the picture plane is parallel to the back face and the front face, and this orange line is parallel. So this is a 45-45-90 triangle, too. And here's where the magic happens, because these are two things that are actually on the canvas. I already showed you them, right? You can put your ruler down, and you can measure it. But that means that this and this have to be the same. That means that the artist was actually standing exactly this far when the artist drew the cube. So now let's go and look at this picture here. This means that the artist is supposed to be standing directly across from this, or the viewer is supposed to be standing directly across from this, and exactly this far away. Okay? So, well, how many of you are standing up here? None of you! If you were standing up there, you would think, this looks really good. This looks just like a cube. It doesn't look like a dumpster. It looks like a cube. Look, I'm going to do it. Oh, yeah, that looks really good. Okay, turn your yellow pages over. Okay, now you'll see this thing to you definitely doesn't look like a cube, does it, at all? This is definitely a dumpster. Okay, which this, if you'll notice, this little diagonal line goes up to the X right here, right? The X. So this is your viewing distance. Put your eyeball close to this eyeball, but about that far away, so like this. And look down and go, oh my gosh, that's a cube. Do you want one, Dad? Great! So is it a cube or is it a dumpster? Well, it is a cube, but it's a bad picture of a cube. Why? Because nobody's going to stand that close to the cube. So a good artist thinks about viewing distance when the artist is drawing the picture, and usually tries to create a good long viewing distance. So if I were really trying to do this picture so that it would look like a real cube, I would probably think, okay, I want my viewing distance to be at least that far, and then I would draw this whole picture backwards. I'd actually draw that little diagonal line first and then draw the back of this, okay? So, okay. Now, this doesn't just work for cute parlor tricks here at the MAA. This also really works in real museums. So I thought it would be fun to practice this. I said the Oath of Hippocrates, but we actually have Durer St. Jerome. So let's actually practice this particular thing with Durer St. Jerome. You have a picture there. This is Durer St. Jerome is a picture that is in one-point perspective, right? You can see that because these lines in the real world are vertical, and they're vertical in the picture, and there's some lines here in the world that are horizontal. So why don't you see, if you have a pencil, you're actually allowed to draw on this picture. Why don't you go ahead and see if you can figure out where's the main vanishing point? That is, there's a whole bunch of lines that run off towards the same direction. Does anybody think you can see more or less in the picture where that is? Yeah, when I do this, I get something like this. So these orange lines, I'm trying to draw like things in the real world and then connect them in yellow, and I get something like this up here, more or less. Okay. Now, notice something interesting about this. I drew the horizon line through here. Notice that if you look below the horizon line, you can see the tops of things, right? You can see the top of the table. And if you look above the horizon line, you can see the bottoms of things. That's another indication that this is where your eye level is supposed to be, somewhere around here. And notice that you can see the left or the right of things if you're over here, which is what you're supposed to do. Okay, so this tells us that our eye is supposed to be out here somewhere. And Durer actually, he did this in this etching appears in a book, and it appears on that page, not that page, so that you were on the right side. Correct side, whatever, yeah. So the next thing that we need to do is we need to like find a cube so we can draw a diagonal line. Does anybody see something that's supposed to be a cube or at least a square? Something that's supposed to be a square. The tabletop. Now, I have seen an art historian say, Durer thought he was really good, but that tabletop doesn't look like a square, it looks like a trapezoid. I think that art historian was in the wrong place. So what happens if you draw the diagonal line across here and you try to hit the green line, the horizon line? I get a viewing distance of about there. Right? That's where I get the second vanishing point. So if you put your eye across from here and about that far out, one of the things that you'll see, and especially if you like roll your eye around, you get a feeling of being in the picture that I don't think we usually get to have when we see art. Especially one of the things I love to do when I'm doing this is roll your eye up and look at the gourd. It's so beautiful. It's really like it's hanging right over here. So these techniques, they actually not only tell you how to draw pictures, but how to go see real pictures in real museums. And why do you want to go see real pictures in real museums? Well, let's do a really quick example. So this is Raphael's Marriage of the Virgin. And notice that it's really the architecture that gives a sense of depth to these. I mean, these people actually look like they're on a stage in front of a curtain, right? They're all horizontal. They're all smushed up here against the front. There's no real depth to the people. But that architecture gives it a real sense of depth, okay? This original painting is about 6 feet tall, something like that. Okay, this is in one-point perspective. The architecture, at least, is in one-point perspective. You can see that right there is the main vanishing point, so you're really supposed to be up above these people. And you can also use these squares in the background to try to figure out where the viewing distance is. So the viewing distance is out here. Now, if you see Raphael's Marriage of the Virgin, and you see this in the museum, this means that you're supposed to stand about 6 to 8 feet back, and you'll get the sense of depth. It's really incredible. But now suppose you see it in the book where I saw it, and it's About 8 inches high. How far are you
supposed to be from the picture?
About 8 inches. And this is really nice that this book has it 8 inches, because most art history books don't have enough space for really big pictures, so they have it about 3 inches. So how far should you be to get that sense of depth? Right. It's really hard to see pictures like that. That's why it's so hard to, like, that's why you need to go to museums, because you need to get at the proper distance. See, if you shrink a picture, if you have a big picture, you can be very far back from the picture, but if you shrink it down, you have to be close to that picture. That's why your vacation photos don't look good. If you take this beautiful picture, you're like, oh my gosh, it's so gorgeous here, it's just like in those calendars. You take a picture and you bring it home and you're like, it was so much better than that. Okay, why is that? Because well, there's not lenses in film now, but pretend there is. The lens is so close to the film compared to your eye. When you have the picture like this, your eye is so far away. What you need to do is take this little photograph that you have. Close one eye, bring it in real close, and go, oh yeah, that's what's come here. You got to say, that's what's liking there. And try that. I mean, I know it seems really crazy, but it's fun. Okay, fun. Okay. And for those of you who don't believe it, unless there's algebra, hang on. So, the height of the object in the real world doesn't change just because you change the size of the photograph. And neither does the artist distance the object in the real world. If you shrink a photograph, what happens is that you shrink the height of the object in the picture. You shrink this little height. And that means that you have to correspondingly shrink your own distance to the picture. That's what's happening. Oh, yeah, so, okay, people believe the algebra, not the geometry. Okay. What happens in two-point perspective? Can we get the lights back on real quick for this? Maybe? Or real slow for this. If you have something in two-point perspective, then the vertical lines are still parallel to the canvas. But there's two directions of horizontal lines that are not parallel to the canvas. This is a picture of a two-point perspective, done by the world famous mathematical artist Piers Iverson. And you can see, like, these lines go over here. They seem to converge to this vanishing point. Those lines can converge to that vanishing point. But when you see this picture in the real world, you don't know where the original building was. You have to think, well, where on earth should I stand? What you do know is you know that in the real world, buildings tend to have 90-degree angles. You can look around here and know what you mean. And so when you see the picture, you know that sometimes you're supposed to make a 90-degree angle above these things. So here we are looking down on the top of this picture point. So maybe we're supposed to be like here. So maybe that's where we're supposed to stand. Or maybe, it turns out that the possible locations are pretty much tightly constrained, and they form this like curve that mathematicians know pretty well. It has a name, actually. This particular curve. Anybody know what name that curve has? Yeah, semicircle. There's a theorem that you learn in geometry that says when you do this with a triangle, you hear it always at 90 degrees. You think, when on earth would I ever need to see this? Well, you need it, because you need this theorem when you go to the museum, because you need to be able to see this vanishing point and figure out how close to be. Most artists, when they're starting two-point perspective, they put these two vanishing points really close together. And it means that you have to be really, really close to the picture. Okay, so you don't have a pink sheet. Shoot. I'm going to hand these out too. So, look at this. This is what Lamise was trying to do. Lamise, one of my students, was trying to draw her name in two-point perspective. She started off with an L. This doesn't look like an L. This looks like a shift. There's no way that angle looks like a 90-degree angle, does it? It's way too sharp. Well, what was she doing? She put her two vanishing points on the paper. This goes together. That means you have to be on a semicircle around here. And so the only way to see this from the right place is to actually, like, put your forehead on the top of the enclosed line, you look down and you go, oh my gosh, that is the right angle. That's so weird. And so you can take it like far away, it's not a right angle. Oh my gosh, it's the right angle. This is like, you can do this for hours, more fun than drugs. Okay. And while you're having fun with this, I'll just do the quick commercial break. We're actually coming out with a book on this. It's called Viewpoints, for reasons that you now understand. Viewpoints, Math and Art book. And it'll be coming out probably in the spring through Princeton University Press. So there's a PDF version of the book online right now. But, Okay.
Can we get the lights back in?
I mentioned at the beginning that good artists like to break the rules. And I actually want to show you the kinds of fun things that you can do once you know the rules and how you can break them. So one of the things that you can do is you can play with people's minds. These are two twins. They're actually the same size, the twins are, even though they look different. This is not trick photography. This is a trick room. This room is actually not a rectangular room like the one we're in. It's trapezoidal. So this wall is actually very far away and very tall. And this wall is short and very close to us. But from a peephole through the front wall, it looks like it's a rectangle. These are not rectangles. They're trapezoids. So this is a twin who's very close to us. She looks large. And that's a twin who's very far away from us. And she looks small. People who are good with cameras love doing things like this. If you actually look at Frodo movie. There's a movie where Frodo and Gandalf come in on a cart together. That's an Ames cart. Yeah, that movie. So what they do is they're ordinary people. They have Gandalf sitting up really close and saying, "Hello, Frodo, my little friend." And Frodo is way far back saying, "Hi, Gandalf." And you can see they don't look exactly like at each other. That's because they're not anywhere near each other. Gandalf is up close, so they're doing something like that. So that's one of a really cool tricks that you can do. It was a perceptual psychologist named Ames who put this together. You can play around with this with other kinds of cool force perspectives. Here's my department secretary being absolutely amazing, holding a student in her bare hand. Well, actually, of course, Sarah was very far back. And the neat thing about this is that it's really tricky to do this. If you're off by even just a little bit, it completely, completely spoils the illusion. Let me show you what I mean by completely spoils the illusion. Here is Sarah standing next to a giant purse. Okay. You might not actually think she's standing next to a giant purse, but you know that I'm trying to tell you that she's standing next to a giant purse, right? So, okay, so I'm not going to be the next Hitchcock or anything like that. But if I moved only 1 foot up from this, this is what it looks like. And there is no way that anybody would think that was a giant purse, right? Even remotely. So the position matters an incredible deal. This is the front piece of a book. The guy who drew this picture, William Hogarth, was having an incredible amount of fun with breaking the rules of perspective and making them really wild and crazy. So things like this, which is supposed to be close to us, is being overlapped by some trees that are supposed to be far away from us and these lines going the wrong direction. He did this as a frontispiece to a book on perspective drawing. It was actually by a guy who is very famous for a lot of the mathematical stuff he did. Actually, this book is really hard to read because it's so dense. And some of you who have taken a course called Calculus 2 might remember some of this guy's stuff. The guy who wrote this book was a guy named Brooke Taylor. And if you've ever seen Taylor's series and struggled through those, that's the same Taylor. So William Hogarth did this. And David Hockney, that artist that I showed you at the beginning, said he thinks that this is actually in some ways a lot more fun and a lot more alive than pictures like Raphael's picture of the Virgin where everybody's like lined up like crazy. So I think it's a lot of fun to know the rules and to break them. Okay, that's what I wanted you to know. So here's the summary of what I needed you to know. Here's two things. Perspective, the first thing you should know is that perspective is based on really simple math. I mean, it's straight lines, similar triangles. But it leads to some good, tricky problems. Anybody get the squirrel on the pedestal problem yet? Okay, good. I figured you would. I was watching your eyes. Okay, the other thing that you need to know, though, is even if you can't solve the squirrel on the pedestal problem, accurate perspective isn't just about the relationship of the screen to the real world. It isn't just what the artist did. It's also about what you do when you go to a museum and you get to look at a piece. So it's also about the relationship of the viewer, you, to the thing that you're looking at. And that's what you need to know. Thank you very much. Okay.